Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the North Carolina General Assembly opens its short session tackling Medicaid. Is a property tax cap or a budget next? Drought continues with the Charlotte area in what is considered extreme drought. Voluntary water conservation measures are in effect. With a flurry of congressional investigations and resignations as background, it is revealed that North Carolina's Alma Adams was investigated for having an inappropriate relationship in 2023, but was later cleared of any wrongdoing, and a merger of two area school systems isn't being viewed that way by everyone.
What we're facing is a hostile takeover.
We hear more about those stories and more from Julian Berger, WFAE's race and equity reporter. Ashley Fay is with us. She's managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. And Alexandria Sands reports for Axios Charlotte. Good morning, everybody. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, Joe, we begin, I think, for the first time on this program with a nothing burger story, but we have to mention it because of recent allegations of wrongdoing by several Congress people and the resignations of some. It was revealed this week that North Carolina's 12th District Congresswoman Alma Adams was investigated by the House Ethics Committee in 2023 over an alleged inappropriate relationship with a member of her staff. It's a nothing burger because the committee found no evidence of wrongdoing on her part. So why is this story just now coming out?
The story was broken by a Washington publication called Notice, like POTUS, but with an N.
News of the United States, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be called The Star soon. They're changing their name, but okay. You didn't ask me about this Washington publication. This was revealed through good reporting, through talking to sources, to talking to people familiar with the complaint. And I have also, since that publication, talked to people who were involved with this. And there are merits to the actual complaint, that this was a toxic work environment, that the actions of one head staffer contributed to many people leaving the office, constituent services being impacted, other parts of the job being acted. However, this central complaint that was investigated, that there was some sort of inappropriate relationship between the Congresswoman and the staffer, that was deemed by this ethics committee, apparently, according to Alma Adams's office, to not have any merits, to no wrongdoing has been committed.
And that coincides with the statement that Alma Adams released, saying that she had cooperated fully with the House Ethics Committee's review, which found, quote, no inappropriate or improper relationship, but added that the committee advised that Congresswoman Adams should work to ensure that no staff received preferential treatment, actual or perceived. So I guess that was the problem. But Alex, yesterday it was revealed that the Ethics Committee released a list of people who had been investigated by that committee going back several years, and this investigation is not on that list. Do we know why?
Yeah, it's just because they said they could not verify the allegations, and that they keep those under wraps. So if it wasn't for this reporting by Notice, we would not know about this. I think that I kind of also wanted to stop reading after I read that these allegations weren't verified, because I was like, why are we talking about this? But I think there is the anonymous sources that Notice spoke to, they are concerned about the work environment. And I think one of the most telling things is that Adams has a very high turnover rate, which I guess this publication was able to verify and report on. And that seems to speak to some of the issues that they're having.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the short session, which may or may not be short. Sometimes it isn't. The North Carolina General Assembly began that session this week, and hope springs eternal that they will finally come to an agreement on a budget, the lack of which has had state and teacher pay raises kind of on hold, I guess is the way to say it. About an hour before the session convened, Governor Josh Stein introduced a budget proposal of his own, focusing on investing in education and not giving tax breaks to corporate shareholders.
But the choice between investing in our children's education and the health of our kids versus giving money to corporate shareholders, or between cutting taxes for working families and cutting taxes for wealthy out-of-staters, I choose North Carolina's kids, families, and future every time.
Does the Republican-controlled legislature generally pay attention to the governor's proposed budget or what he has to say about it, what he'd like to see in that budget? Or do they pay attention to the governor of any party, Joe?
You know, I think it's a nice suggestion from the governor. This is about his 1,000th budget proposal since the state has been deadlocked here, but they certainly don't just take what he gives them and go off of that. If you were hoping for the lawmakers to make the budget the first thing they did when they got back into session, unfortunately, you left disappointed. It still seems like they aren't on the same page. I think that a budget will get done, but it doesn't look like it's going to get done next week. It might still take some time. There's still some differences between the House and the Senate.
Yeah, the governor's proposal totals $35.24 billion. How does that compare with either the House or Senate versions of their budget?
I don't have the exact figure for the House or Senate. I Phil Berger came out with a statement saying it would be like the largest tax increase ever. I don't know if that's factual, or just hyperbole. At the end of the day, the nitty gritty details are going to get ironed out by the House with the tax rates, as well as with the funding for the Children's Hospital in the Triangle area. Those are the two big holdups.
And as you point out, there are differences between the House Republican budget and the Senate Republican budget, and that's what's been holding up the passage of this budget for the whole year so far. But Governor Stein is recommending a 2.5% raise for all state employees this fiscal year and again next fiscal year, and he wants to also give them a bonus. How does that compare with what the House and Senate see as possible raises for these folks? Do we know?
I think that's generally in line with what we will see from the House and Senate proposals. I know the House's proposed budget is a little more probably favorable for teachers than what the Senate was proposing, and the House's budget was a little more in line with what Governor Stein wants. But, this conversation is going to take place in a back room in Raleigh somewhere, and we'll hopefully get details at some point in the next couple of weeks.
And as usual, the governor wants more money for education and for the General Assembly to pass its first comprehensive budget since 2023, I think. We haven't had a real budget since then. The legislature has been focused, however, on tax cuts, something that Stein wants to pause. Who is in line to benefit from whatever tax cuts may come to pass?
One of the big ones is the corporate tax rate. It's just set to fall if they hit certain revenue goals, the state. And, you know, at some point, I think what the House is concerned about and what Governor Stein is concerned about is just that, you know, eventually, like, it's going to be too low. We're not going to be collecting enough revenue. So they don't want to raise the taxes. They just want to hit the pause on it for right now while they identify more revenue sources.
And Governor Stein is also calling for a rollback of the state's Opportunity Scholarship Program, which provides vouchers to every child to be used on private school education. Stein says these vouchers have not been used as they were originally intended. How so?
I mean, I think one of the big things with that is that everybody is eligible for them. You know, when the program was originally designed, it was targeted towards people of lower income to make sure that they are on a fair playing field with getting into private schools. There's like zero chance that I think that Republicans will roll back opportunity scholarships. I think generally they are seen as pretty popular with the people who use them. And just nationwide, it's property taxes and school choice that really are big platforms for Republicans that have they've been able to implement.
Although the governor points out that over the next decade, I think he said, the vouchers will siphon off about $7.5 billion from the public schools. And he says that money is needed in the public sphere. He says that rural communities – residents there they can't take advantage of these scholarships because they don't have any options. They don't have charter schools, and they don't have very many private schools to which their kids can go. They're paying taxes, but they're not getting the benefit of these scholarships. That's something we have never talked about on this program, at least, when we have talked about the negatives of the school voucher program. How serious a problem is this?
I think that's a great story idea that in some of these rural counties, I mean, certainly I'm not familiar with many private schools in some of these rural counties in our listening and viewing areas. But I don't have the figures for exactly how many families are paying into this program and whether or not they are getting enough eligible schools that they could potentially use it.
Meanwhile, leaders of the UNC system are asking lawmakers to provide nearly $159 million in additional funding to support enrollment growth across the UNC system. UNC Charlotte Chancellor Sharon Gaber says the lack of funding is making it harder for her to add faculty. She says UNC Charlotte has one of the highest student-to-faculty ratios in the state.
Meaning we are already educating more students per faculty member than any other institution. That is difficult. Without enrollment funding, these pressures intensify.
Any reaction at all from lawmakers on that?
Not that I'm aware of, but okay. Again, it's all going to be in the budget.
Okay, speaking of the budget, Julian, because of the lack of a budget, Medicaid funding in the state was likely to run out sometime around October, but there is a bill working its way through the short session that would backfill the Medicaid shortfall and then ensure that it is funded for the remainder of the year. The bill's moving quickly. It has bipartisan support. How much money would it provide?
It would be about $319 million. To cover the shortfall of this fiscal year.
And there's another provision in this bill which would require the State Department of Health and Human Services to refer some Medicaid applicants to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. This has caused some concern because they want to make sure that their citizenship can be verified. This has immigrant advocates very concerned. What has been the feedback from members
of
the General
Assembly?
Yeah, the
feedback
has been... Wait, hold it. Feedback from the General Assembly to the concern. We'll talk about the concerns in a minute. What has been the feedback from the General Assembly to those concerns?
Yeah, so they're kind of... The Democrats that I've spoken to, they're kind of stuck in a rock and a hard place because they want this funding to be passed, but Republicans put in all of these provisions, and unfortunately, if they want this funding, they have to agree and abide by these provisions.
Do we know if or how many undocumented immigrants take advantage or are on the Medicaid rolls right now? Do we know?
So we don't know. Undocumented immigrants, they're not able to get any Medicaid benefits unless it's an emergency. So somebody's pregnant and they give birth. That's considered an emergency service. But non-citizens in North Carolina, about 2% of the people that have Medicaid in North Carolina are non-citizens. So that includes visa holders, green card holders, but undocumented immigrants cannot have regular Medicaid coverage.
Because Republicans have been concerned about undocumented people voting. I don't think there are very many instances of that actually occurring, but it's a good political point. Is this a political point or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, it seems very political and it seems to kind of align with the federal government as well, trying to make sure that only people that are citizens and that have legal status can seek benefits.
So when we come back, we will talk about the fears of the immigrant community that this proposal is causing and why. And we'll also look at something else that the legislature is considering, and that is a cap on property taxes and a moratorium, a pause in how often these property tax revaluations occur. Some places they occur by law, including Mecklenburg County. We'll do that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are here with Julian Berger, our race and equity reporter at WFAE News. Ashley Fahey joins us from the Charlotte Ledger. Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV and Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. We were talking about Medicaid reform proposals working their way through the short session of the General Assembly. Immigrant advocates, Julian, fear that if the provision that would make the Department of that would require the state the state's Health and Human Services Department to check in with the Department of Homeland Security on the validity of some applicants who are trying to get into or are in the Medicaid system. They're worried that this would deter eligible immigrant families from seeking Medicaid in the first place, eligible families, particularly in mixed status households where some family members are U.S. citizens and others are not. And you report that Doug C. with the Charlotte Center for Legal Advocacy says the impact of this would likely extend beyond undocumented immigrants.
This will just continue that trend of trying to intimidate families with citizen children as well as legal immigrants who came as refugees, came as asylees.
So do we know how many people that might likely affect?
Yeah, so like I said, there's about 2.1 Medicaid recipients in the state who are non-citizens. And I mean, you have mixed status families, like you said, that their kids are citizens and they are eligible for Medicaid. Or for example, you have, you know, undocumented parents, but the kids were born here, so they're eligible for Medicaid. So we don't know the numbers, but it does seem to that it will have a ripple effect in the immigrant community once this bill is approved.
Kelly Morales, who's the head of Siembra, North Carolina, a Latino community organizing group, says, quote, "This isn't about eligibility. It's about terrorizing parents who just want to take their kids to a doctor," end quote. What else did she tell you?
Yeah, so it was a statement that was sent to me. I think the fear is just, it's big in the immigrant community, but there's also other provisions in this bill that will target how much people work. So there would be work requirements. You have to work 80 hours a month in order to be eligible for Medicaid. There would be eligibility checks monthly now. So there's a lot of strict provisions that a lot of Democrats in the House and the Senate, they're against these provisions, but they have to succumb to them in order to pass this funding.
And she worries that this would turn county workers into informants, correct?
That's right. And that was a big conversation on the House floor on Wednesday. Just the amount of work that would be put in to do all of these eligibility checks without any more resources, without any more manpower.
Despite all that, Republican House Speaker Destin Hall says the goal of this bill is to make sure the right people are getting on Medicaid.
Some of the other provisions in the bill really relate to making sure we're cutting out waste, fraud, abuse, ramping up a bit on the renewal of procedures to make sure that, you know, folks who are being renewed actually continue to meet the program's requirements, that we're not just making it the goal to put as many people as possible on Medicaid.
Were we ever doing that, trying to put as many people as possible on Medicaid? That's question one. And what question two is, what does he mean by the right people?
Right. I'm not a Medicaid expert, but I know that there are certain things, rules and procedures in place to make sure that people are eligible. So I'm not sure if that is true, what he's saying.
Okay. Another thing under discussion in the legislature's short session is the possibility of imposing, Joe, a property tax cap on counties. Why are they considering this, and what do General Assembly members think this would accomplish?
Property taxes countrywide are a big topic, especially with Republican legislatures. The thing that they're considering is a constitutional amendment that would allow voters this November to decide whether there should be a property tax cap. We don't know the details of it yet, what this exactly would mean, but it would basically limit the amount of property taxes, or won't be allowed to go above a certain rate or a certain percentage for counties statewide. So this is a big deal, and it will be addressed this session, and it is something that counties and cities across the state are starting to take stands against.
Of course, this is coming at a time when Mecklenburg County is facing some money problems, and they want to consider, they are said to be considering a property tax increase coming up. And on Tuesday, the county commission unanimously passed a resolution against the General Assembly's proposal because it would reduce local flexibility and undermine fiscal stability, their words. And Commissioner George Dunlap scolded Raleigh for being part of the county's need to raise those taxes. He used school funding as an example, saying that Mecklenburg County spends $500 million annually on CMS, which is something that should be, he says, the state's responsibility, and that's something he says our community needs to understand.
That's where people are going to get it wrong if they vote for this cap, thinking that they're going to get a reduction. They'd get that reduction if the state funded the system.
Is he wrong?
I don't think he's wrong. I think that, you know, the county dedicates a lot of its money to the local teacher supplement and to CMS that they view should be funded by the state and that many people view should be funded by the state.
One other thing that Phil Berger, the Senate leader, wants to consider in this session is a pause, I guess, mm-hmm. in the frequency of revaluations. Property tax revaluations in some communities, including Mecklenburg County, they come along every couple of years on a set frequency because it's in statute to do so. And there was a period, Joe, if I recall correctly, where we didn't do that, and suddenly we were hit with a whammy of a tax increase because they hadn't done it in so long. So they say doing it on a frequency of every 2 years or so lessens the burden on taxpayers. Why would Phil Berger want to do this?
Yeah, it's every 4 years for Mecklenburg County. It used to be eight. There are only a handful of counties doing reval this year. The only one in our listening viewing area is Anson County, but one of the counties is Guilford, where, you know, it's his district. And one of the things that he is saying is that he kind of wants there to be some property tax relief now because the constitutional amendment that is being proposed for November, like that won't go into effect. That doesn't help the people undergoing revaluation right now. Reval is when a lot of people see their tax bill change because, you know, things get shifted, the tax burden shifts from residential or from commercial to residential. So his view is let's help these counties right now that are going through revaluation while the voters have their say in November. Now, these counties are probably losing it, if I had to guess, because they're trying to plan their budgets and they don't know what's going to happen if they're able to, you know, reset the tax rate this July. So that is something that really needs to be looked into.
And these counties would say, because ours has said, that the state is not fully funding their obligations, and so it's falling on the counties to come up with the money to do that. Not only includes the teacher supplement at CMS, it includes taking care of roads that the state are supposed to be taking care of, but they're not. So they're between a rock and a hard place because they need to raise funds to take over for the state in the state's obligations that are not being funded. So where do we stand here? What's going to happen?
We'll have to see if some of these more Republican-leaning counties take a stand against this and apply pressure to lawmakers. I don't think Mecklenburg and Wake are going to be able to solve this on their own. But if some of these more rural or Republican-leaning counties voice concerns and show that they're is it going to be a significant impact, I think that will go a long way.
So before we move on to other topics other than the General Assembly's short session, this session is different in part because Senate Leader Phil Berger has returned as a lame duck. He lost his reelection bid to Republican Rockingham Sheriff Sam Page by 23 votes. It was, by any measure, a stunning upset and one that will shift the power structure in the General Assembly. And Berger has led this organization since 2011. Has the jockeying for position begun? Joe?
It's going on behind the scenes, not really so much in public yet, but yes, it has. And I think it's early to say who the front runner is.
So Berger met with reporters, I think on Tuesday, just before the short session began, and was asked what lesson he took from his defeat.
I think that Democrats like to vote in some Republican primaries. I think that's the message.
That's the message. So do we have any evidence that significant numbers of Democrats voted in the Republican primary in Guilford County and Rockingham County just to defeat Phil Berger?
If that number can be found out, I do think that Democrats probably did play a role in Berger losing because the margin was so tight. And naturally, if you're an unaffiliated Democratic-leaning voter in that race in particular, you're going to choose the Republican ballot just because of how, you know, intense it was. They were getting mail every single day. It was every single television commercial. So yes, I think Democrats played a role, but I think that he didn't lose because of Democrats. I think there are other factors at play in that race.
He would agree with you because he also assailed early voting, saying that 17 days of early voting just seems pretty excessive. Those are his words. And he suggested that lawmakers reconsider the number of days the state allows for early voting in primaries. Can he get that done before he leaves?
He could probably bring something to the floor, but I think that I don't know if that's going to have a veto-proof majority to change the early voting across statewide. North Carolina has great elections. We have a good system, and I don't know if there's an appetite to really make dramatic changes like that.
Well, let's move on. It's dry. I was actually surprised, Julian, to find that Mecklenburg County is in a state of extreme drought, because my recollection was that we had a pretty wet winter, we had a snowfall, etc. But I was mistaken in that impression, because in fact the period from January to March was the third driest on record, dating back to 1895. How bad is it? Well, here's what Union County wheat farmer Drew Medlin told WSOC-TV.
I'm 42 years old, and I've never seen a drought this time of year to this extent.
So the whole state is dry, and most of Mecklenburg, Union, Cabarrus, Iredell, and Rowan counties, and counties to our west, are in extreme drought. Mecklenburg County has issued voluntary water use restrictions. They did that on Monday. What are they asking, Julian? What are they asking residents to do?
Yeah, so just conserve water, especially if you are watering your lawn. Just make sure that it is not in the hottest times of the day, that it's either in morning or at night. Also consider not washing your car, going to community car washes where they recycle water. Just taking voluntary steps to preserve water for now. There really isn't any things that you have to do right now. It's all very voluntary.
Yeah, but although it's reminiscent of the gas shortage of the 70s or 80s, when odd numbered license plates could get gas on one day and even numbered license plates could get gas on the next day. What they're asking here is that even numbered addresses water on Wednesday and Sunday, and odd numbered addresses water on Tuesday and Saturday. What happens on Monday? I don't know. where do our water levels stand? Because we get our water from the Catawba River Basin. Has that declined visibly? Because several years ago, you could see the river levels were visibly, alarmingly low.
Yeah, so our climate reporter is Zach Turner. He's been out there and he's seen declining levels. He also was telling me that the worst drought on record was in 2007, and we were in a 17-inch deficit, and right now we're at a 15-inch deficit. So we're inching towards that record from 2007.
A Union County also implemented what they call stage one of their drought plan. Do you know how that impacts water use in Union County? You may not know. I'm just asking.
Not sure. But Zach was also telling me that Union County and the east side of Charlotte would be the first to kind of see these increasing levels, where there would have to be required water conservation because they are kind of more on the drier parts of the region.
And getting back to farmers, we heard from a farmer in Union County a second ago. Wheat farmers in Union County say that this drought has become a major concern. And one farmer told Channel 9 that if rain doesn't fall this week, his entire crop could be at risk. And although wheat thrives in dry weather, right now it is too dry, too hot, and too early for it to be this dry to successfully grow wheat. And they added that wheat is the first crop that goes to harvest and sets the tone for the year. But with the drought and rising fuel and fertilizer prices because of the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, some farmers are now wondering if they will make it through the year. And that, my friends, affects food prices and food availability. So let's move on. WFAE obtained an internal memo indicating, I think yesterday, that Kathy Bessant is stepping down as CEO of Foundation for the Carolinas, effective yesterday, Alex. At first, it was put forth in that memo, I think, as a resignation, but today I read that it's a retirement, immediate retirement. What else do we know?
We know that the way they're framing this is that it was planned that they had this succession in mind, where Laura Yates Clark is going to take over. She was formerly the CEO of the United Way of Greater Charlotte, and she joined the foundation in May 2024. So she's also been there a short period, but I think Kathy, she came on to the foundation after retiring from Bank of America. It's possible she's just ready for retirement, but this will be, this is a big transition. This is a really big role in the community. It's a very powerful role, and it's an unelected official that controls a lot of money, has a lot of power. So,
yeah, Foundation for the Carolinas is one of the most successful philanthropic organizations in the country, of its kind at least, and they manage more than $4 billion in charitable assets. So whoever runs this operation has a big job. Data centers, Ashley, have become controversial, as we all know. Many times they hit roadblocks from citizens asking for project delays. But this week, a developer asked for a delay for an East Charlotte data center. 1 month delay. That's unusual. Why do they want to delay the project?
Yeah, my suspicion, Mike, is that they're kind of reading the room. A lot of council members have said they want a moratorium on data centers so that the issue of data centers can be more closely examined and some policy and regulations around data centers can actually be written into city governance to help guide rezoning decisions. A few folks have brought up the fact that this rezoning petition and maybe a few others would be coming up before those regulations would be developed. I reported a couple weeks ago that the city is working on those regulations, but it might take 3 to 6 months to actually have those recommendations.
So when we come back from the break, we'll talk a little bit more about that and hear from one city council member who said it wants exactly what you just talked about. But we'll hear from her as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Julian Berger, WFAE's race and equity reporter. Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axia. Charlotte Joe Bruno reports for WSOC-TV. And Ashley Fahey is managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. Just before the break, Ashley, we were talking about developer for a proposed East Charlotte data center requesting a one-month delay on a rezoning petition that it filed. This is near the Reedy Creek Nature Preserve, and the American Tower Corporation is the company that asked City Council to delay consideration of its request until May 18th. I think you said they were taking the temperature of the room when they made this request, but what do they hope to accomplish by a delay?
Yeah, this is sometimes a tactic that developers will use to try to build consensus with community members, whether it's some community benefits or some concessions, whether it could be additional buffer space around the project or some other things that, you know, make it so that the community maybe doesn't come out in opposition during the public hearing, which I think is what they were sensing would happen. Thousands of people have signed a petition against the project. Mm-hmm. Even though the project didn't have its public hearing today, about a dozen people were at the government center protesting it this week. So I think they're just kind of reading the room and seeing that there's a lot of opposition. Can we get to some consensus before it goes before Charlotte City Council?
Greg Asciuto, who is executive director of community nonprofit Charlotte East, says that whatever decision council makes could set a, quote, disastrous precedent citywide. What is he most concerned about?
Yeah, I think the concern is that if you approve one data center, does this open the floodgates for a bunch of others to get filed in town, especially because there isn't policy right now that sort of either puts guardrails or restrictions around data centers. What's been brought up is that even though data centers are only allowed in certain zoning districts in the city, there's really no other guidance around them. And the data centers of 2000s is very different than the data centers that are being built today. They just require so much more power. speaking of water, they require a lot of water. And some people are just worried about having the data center so close to their home. Some council members have said we should not allow data centers near any residential neighborhoods, and that should be written into policy. But we don't have that right now. The city doesn't have that right now written into law. So that's what I think a lot of the consternation is around.
These data centers, as I picture them, and maybe I'm completely wrong, are these just big warehouse type structures with no windows? And do they make a lot of noise? I mean, are people concerned about the noise from this brick building or whatever it's made out of?
Yeah, they are basically just a box building. I mean, there's no other way to describe it beyond that. But yeah, the humming noise that some people say they produce is a concern, and being especially close to any neighborhoods. I know that's something council member Dimple Ajmera has mentioned, and she's an East Charlotte resident. That's something she's heard from constituents, that there's a fear that humming noise, the impact of quality of life, you know, having this facility near the neighborhood is not exactly appealing or something they want.
Dimple Ajmera says the city, quote, should not move forward with projects near residential communities until we have clear standards on water, energy, and community impact. And she proposed a moratorium on all data centers until the city has a regulation on the books. April Alexander is an East Charlotte resident who lives near the proposed data center site. She's concerned about the facility and what it would mean for the area, but she says a conversation about community protections would help ease her mind.
And I'm still concerned about it being in a residential neighborhood and, again, people not having a say. And then, too, I would love to hear more about safeguards.
So will we have to wait till May 18th to find out what happens next?
I think that's when the rezoning petition will come before council. So that's when we'll have the public hearing. But I am curious to see what will change between now and then, and if there's any concessions that are reached. I will note this is a 40,000 square foot smaller data center than the big hyperscalers we keep hearing about. Those locate on much bigger sites. But I think there's still this concern of precedent that those facilities could then follow this one.
So it seems that every week this month, we've been hearing an announcement about a bank bringing jobs to our area. And this week, J.P. Morgan Chase, the nation's largest bank, announced they were adding jobs and consolidating and expanding local operations in South Park, where they already have, I think, a headquarters that Jamie Dimon came to open, if I'm not mistaken. How many jobs are we talking about, Ashley?
Yeah, so they have 600 currently here, and they're adding another 400. So that would, of course, bring their headcount to about 1,000 over the next couple of years. And to your point, this is kind of the latest, and it feels like a weekly announcement from some big bank or financial services company. J.P. Morgan did not, however, get incentives or anything. It was just something they decided to do. They consolidated their real estate in South Park. This will take a couple years to kind of get online. But yeah, I mean, it's the big, like you said, biggest bank in U.S. and a big name for Charlotte, and kind of just adds to the momentum we've been seeing.
Alex, you say that many of these jobs will be in the commercial and investment banking and private banking portions of that bank. What about the consumer side?
Are you talking, like, do you mean bank branches?
Well, I'm just saying that you said in your writing that many of these jobs will be in commercial, investment banking, and private banking. What about the consumer side?
Yeah, they have the roles they're talking about are commercial investment banking, but also private and consumer banking. And they also have a lot of bank branch employees here. They're opening, I think they have nearly 30, and they're continuing that. So I don't know the exact number there. But as far as the actual corporate offices go, those are the lines that they're focused on.
You also report that J.P. Morgan Chase is apparently bullish on Charlotte's workforce. Is that because we are already a banking center with Bank of America and Wells Fargo and others here?
It's a few things. They recognize that there's a lot of talent here because it is a banking hub. They also said they've had a lot of success with getting people to move to Charlotte. So when they're trying to recruit, it's very easy to say, to find people who want to move to North Carolina because they like the weather and all the benefits of living here. And that's something that they've just found and a reason that they see a good reason to expand.
So Ashley, despite these banks making these major announcements in recent weeks, Charlotte evidently leads the state this year in the number of job layoffs. This influx of companies like J.P. Morgan Chase, the Japanese megabank SMBC that we talked about a couple weeks ago, and others is happening, however, even over concerns about the intrusion of AI on white-collar jobs. Will these new jobs be momentary? Is this a blip before the deluge of AI?
I do think, Mike, and this is a bit of a non-answer, but I do think that's an open question. I mean, JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon himself has come out and said, you know, we are using AI and it will, you know, it will create some job losses and things of that nature. But clearly there's other aspects of their service lines that they think they need to hire humans for. So I do think that's an open question. A lot of companies are still in the very early stages of AI adoption. So I don't think we've seen sort of the hammer fall yet. But banking is one of the industries that's been identified as potentially the most vulnerable to AI displacement because it uses a lot of researchers, data, things that AI can actually do pretty well. Yeah. So I guess that's a TBD question. And I think that applies to all of these kind of companies that are moving here is, you know, will some of these jobs eventually be displaced by AI? It could be. We just don't know yet.
Do we have any idea of what the average pay for these jobs that JP Morgan Chase announced this week will be?
I don't think they disclosed that. And since they didn't get incentives, it wasn't something that they were required to disclose. So I would imagine six figures easily, though.
Okay. A new development this week in the Mooresville mayor saga, Joe. Remind us, please, if you will, because I don't want to have to talk about it again, what this is all about.
Mooresville mayor was caught after hours in town hall without his pants on and with a female communications consultant. Okay. He claims he was drunk, got sick on his pants, took them off, and WBTV sued, trying to get the video, find out what was going on in there, and Mooresville has been fighting ever since.
Yeah, the WBTV successfully sued. One judge said, okay, release the video, but then the town of Mooresville came back and said, on appeal, and said, please don't release the footage, and an appeals judge blocked the release. Why?
For now. They're going to hear the merits of the case. Mooresville thinks that this is going to set some very large precedent with releasing sensitive security video, and that is why they are pressing forward with the appeal. Remember, attorney fees are racking up here. The taxpayers are already angry at this situation. They're going to be funding even more of this fight, not to mention all of the other lawsuits that have been filed against the town that are semi-connected or directly connected to this incident.
Stay tuned. I'm sure we'll be talking about this again in the very near future. Ashley, United Airlines CEO Scott Kirby recently floated the idea of a merger with American Airlines, but American CEO Robert Isom is more than cool on this idea. What has he said about the possibility?
Yeah, American has come out and said that they're not engaged with any discussions with United about a merger with the airline. You know, they've said things like it would be negative for competition and for consumers. They did acknowledge, though, that changes in the broader airline marketplace may be necessary. And there's been chatter about some of the other carriers about whether they're looking to put themselves up for sale outside of American. So I do think there could be some other movements that happen, but it doesn't seem likely that this United American Airlines merger is actually going to happen.
It is said that this would be a merger of the two largest airlines in the world. I had no idea that United and American are the two largest airlines in the world. Why would United want this? Are they facing money troubles?
I don't think so. I think it would just be more, honestly, it could be some industry analysts have suggested that United floated the possibility to see what other carriers, like maybe JetBlue, it could maybe merge with. You know, it doesn't seem likely, again, that this merger with American would happen because President Trump has come out against it. A bipartisan group of senators has come out against it. But it could be them just putting that out there to see what the appetite is right now for approval of such a deal with maybe another carrier. But yeah, I mean, it would hurt consumers. It would certainly reduce competition and create a behemoth airline, which I don't think would be politically or otherwise popular.
Yeah, and this is happening at the same time that the administration is considering a bailout of Spirit Airlines, the low-cost airline. Isom, the head of American, says this, as you said, this merger will hurt consumers. Is that because it would reduce choice and possibly raise prices, allow airlines to charge more fees on carrying your purse on board? I mean, is that what he's talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it's the simple economics of it, basically, that if you have fewer competitors, you know, you have more control of the market and therefore can charge higher fees and things of that
nature. Why would he be worried about that?
Maybe it's just a political talking point. Who knows?
Okay. Meanwhile, another possible merger of a totally different sort is getting a mixed reaction. Joe, the Catawba County Board of Commissioners voted on Tuesday in favor of a controversial proposal to merge Catawba County schools with the smaller Hickory and Newton Conover districts. Schools always get the attention of parents, and so meetings about this are overloaded with parents in the audience. Many were in attendance for this meeting. What is the prevailing feeling about this possibility?
I think it's mixed. I think on one side, you have people who think this is a necessary move because of declining enrollment, because of deteriorating buildings, just becoming larger in their view is better for everyone. However, I think if you're a parent in some of these smaller districts like Hickory City, you might be worried that maybe the school lines are going to be redrawn. Maybe you're not going to have as much attention in a larger school district as opposed to the one that you're currently in right now. This still has to be approved by the State Board of Education. So like for those who are opposed, they still have a little bit of a dog in the fight, but certainly a contentious issue in the Catawba Valley.
One retired school teacher in Catawba County accused the commissioners of not doing their homework on this. She said, "There's no evidence in your proposed merger that you have adequately prepared or communicated the potential effects of this school merger." But when Tim Hayes spoke, it got worse. Hayes is a school board member with Newton Conover Schools.
"What's being proposed is not a merger. A true merger means two or more parties voluntarily coming together as equals. What we're facing is a hostile takeover, a forced transfer of control over our school district without consent of our elected school board or our community."
So the superintendents of both Newton Conover and Hickory also oppose the merger. Opponents want to pause this move so there can be a more comprehensive analysis of its impact. Again, the Catawba County Board of Commissioners voted in favor of this merger, but they don't have the final word. Is that correct?
That's correct. State Board of Education will ultimately decide.
So there's going to be a teacher demonstration in Raleigh on May 1st. Now several school districts are canceling classes for a lack of teachers. Kannapolis announced this week that they are among those people. And CMS is holding a emergency session to adjust their calendar to account for that. There were previous protests in 2018 and 19 for higher pay and more funding for schools. Did they have any effect, Joe?
"We don't have a budget, Mike. there have been raises. I don't know. There have been raises. I don't know if the raises that were implemented are necessarily, there's always more that can be done for our teachers. Okay. Let's just put it that way."
I want to get into a story very quickly because we don't have a lot of time that you reported on this week called Operation High Octane. And we're not talking about gasoline. This was a joint effort of the Mecklenburg County Alcoholic Beverage Control Board and the North Carolina ABC Commission, a year-long undercover operation. About what?
High-end bourbon being sold on the secondary market. I don't know if you're a bourbon guy, Mike, but to get some of these rare bottles, you have to have a little bit of luck. And sometimes people acquire the bottles from out of state or a buddy, and then they sell them for a lot of money. And they're doing this in group chats or on Discord servers, and they're talking in code. And it's these undercover officers had to be invited into certain group chats by like multiple people to prove that they are willing to be in it. And then they were able to infiltrate them, get all this liquor. And after the judge orders it to do so, they will destroy it.
Is there any other way to buy these rare bottles of bourbon?
I didn't hear the first part of what you said.
Is there any other way to buy these rare bottles of bourbon? Can you go to the ABC store? Can you go to Frugal McDougal's?
You'll have a better luck at Frugal McDougal's. But no, I mean, there are lotteries for the opportunity to buy a bottle. That is how hard it is to get one in Mecklenburg County.
I have 10 seconds. The NFL draft is underway. How did we do?
He's a 6'7", 315-pound man who is going to do very well on the offensive line. Monroe Freeling.
Okay. I'll leave it
at
that.
That's his name.
I have more questions, but I have no more time. Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Alexandria Sands from Axios Charlotte, Ashley Fahey from the Charlotte Ledger, and Julian Berger from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.